Success in life is like kind of like luck meets preparation, or preparation meets luck, whatever comes first. And so the semiconductor stocks just got hammered in the summer of 1995. And I was a young 22, 23 at that point. And our founder was like, let's go down and check out, you know, companies like Applied Materials, because they were all down because there was an excess supply of chips. Prices were low, profits low, stocks down. We've heard this story before. And then back then it was all about the PC cycle. And, you know, Windows coming out and new upgrades, and we happened to hit a cycle, and kind of the rest was history after that. So it was just really just, I'm lucky it was semiconductors that were cheap at that point and not something that doesn't exist anymore. So that started a 30-year journey, and I've been through 8 semiconductor cycles now.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? That opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by Todd Alston. Todd is the Chief Investment Officer of Parnassus Investments, which manages $46 billion in AUM, and Todd is also the lead portfolio manager of both the Parnassus Core Equity and Core Select strategies. Beyond Parnassus, Todd is also a member of the exclusive Barron's Roundtable. Todd, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on. Welcome to AUM.
Well, thanks so much for the kind words, Ryan. I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
And we're going to dig in mostly to the Parnassus investment process and some of the themes, trends you guys tend to invest around. But before we do that, I do want to dig in a bit to your career. When did you first develop an interest for investing?
So that's a great place to start, Ryan. That goes way back in time. So when I was a young kid, you know, 10, 12 years old, I loved games of chance, puzzles, baseball cards, and statistics. So I was really into numbers and math, and again, games of chance and kind of thoughtful kind of analysis. So like when I was then 13 years old, I had one of those real light bulb moments where my dad was a pilot at Transworld Airlines. And when your dad's a pilot, it's super cool. You get to fly for free. And it was really just a special childhood. But where this really came into the intersection of investing is this guy named Carl Icahn, who's a household name, corporate raider. He made a bid and bought the airline. And in essence, my dad came home from a flight and he said, this corporate raider is buying the airline because he thinks the parts of the airline are worth more than the whole. And I was like, Dad, what does that mean? He's like, well, he thinks he can sell the planes and the routes for more than the company's worth. And I'm like, well, Dad, wait a minute. Like, what does that really mean tangibly? He's like, it's like buying a car for $10,000 and selling the parts for $20,000. And then instantly at that moment, I was like, wow, that's like how companies are valued. So it caused an intersection of baseball, stats, games of chance, an airline that was bought by a corporate raider. And then I started reading the Wall Street Journal every day, and kind of the rest is history. So I think that Christmas I got the subscription to the Wall Street Journal, had my mom drop me off the library because, you know, we didn't have something called the internet back in 1986, 85. And that's really how I got an interest in the markets. And it's been really a lifelong journey since then, Ryan.
And you are now celebrating 30 years at Parnassus. I believe you just lapped that anniversary. So congratulations. How did you end up there to begin with?
So I was going to Berkeley, the Haas School of Business undergrad, and a good friend of mine had just finished an internship at Parnassus where you come in for the summer, you pick a couple stocks, give a presentation. And I'm like, wow, that's exactly what I want to do. So in the fall of 1994, I got an internship here at Parnassus and got to meet our founder, Jerry Dodson, and pitched a couple stocks. And we happened to hit it off. And that was just at the time the company was starting to grow. I think we're roughly $150 million in assets. So he was looking to hire an analyst. And so lo and behold, I was a 22-year-old and I was hired and started working here in early 1995. And I'm 30 years later, still here. So really, it was an internship that I got through a friend of mine. And it started the gears rolling for a lifelong career.
Looking back to those early years, what skills do you think you had coming into Parnassus? What were your talents like then? And then what skills do you think you've best developed over your time there over the last 30 years?
Gosh, you know, Ryan, that's such a great question, because I think when I came in, kind of from the introduction, I was really into numbers and games of chance and probabilities. But at some point, numbers only take you so far in picking stocks. There has to be combining it to the narrative of a company. And I think for me, it was really connecting the numbers and accounting part of it to the actual business fundamentals of a company and its cash flow and its like intrinsic value. I think what I've helped or been able to develop since then is really you can get an edge in this business on two sources. Number one is you have an analytical edge, right? And that's really hard with efficient markets. Or there's an edge around the behavioral side of the business, which is like the actual narrative of how a stock trades in the market, which is actually code word for the multiple it trades at, or is it in favor or out of favor or sentiment. So I think over time, I was able to kind of transition from a numbers investor to like build around the narrative, connecting the fundamentals. And then ultimately, the behavioral aspect of how the stock trades in the market is where the alpha generation comes from. So to be a successful investor, you have to do a little bit of all three, of have that analytical ability, the ability to connect the numbers to the narrative, and then obviously the behavioral side of how that stock then gets valued in the market. And then finally, I happen to have a more extroverted personality. So it was really getting out and meeting people, executives, investors. And so in the early days, there wasn't podcasts and shows like this, Ryan, where like you had to go out and literally meet people to learn the craft. And it was a different time from that. So then the fourth intersection is just combining like lifelong relationships that have been built over 30 years.
Makes sense. And you mentioned there sort of markets have gotten more competitive. And so having the analytical edge has gotten maybe a little tougher. Part of that, I also would imagine, is there's way more, and I love this term that you used, way more short shelf life information. And you mentioned that in a previous interview you did. I'm curious, are there any specific habits or things you do to help kind of process new information to really be able to differentiate between, okay, that's short shelf life versus that's something that actually is going to impact the business long-term? Is there anything, I guess, habits that you have that help?
Yeah, thanks for asking that, Ryan. That really comes back to the investing process that we have at Parnassus, and also for our ETF, the Core Select Fund, is when you see news every day, there's a lot of noise, right? And like, we're all searching for the signal versus the noise. And what I would say is the kind of life hack here, how to open the aperture to find the signal, is you just connect it back to your process. And it sounds so simple, but two of the main pillars we have, number one is we want to invest in companies that have wide business moats. As you know, a moat is what you put around your business. It protects it. It's durable, sustainable, competitive advantage. So when you look at the daily news, what are the actual dynamics you're seeing that impacts a company's durable competitive advantage? And you know, if it doesn't, it's probably largely noise. And number two is we want companies that no matter what they make, sell, it's got to be more relevant and important in our lives long term, which is code where it's got to at least outgrow its industry or the economy. So if news is coming out and it's not durably going to impact a company's business moat, or it's not going to impact its long-term relevancy in the market, it's most likely noise. So it's like think about the process we have. And then finally, you want to think about, is this news item today, which could be signal or noise, is it something that we'll be talking about in a year from now? And if it's not, and it doesn't fit into our process of, is it building a company's moat? Is it making a company more relevant? Is it long-term impacting the company's narrative or sentiment? Then it's most likely noise. And so I think that's really the template that I would think about using. And that's what I use to try to help the batting average of signal versus noise.
Do you personally do anything to try to like filter out the new, like the noise, I guess? We see this all the time where people are trying to decipher between noise versus actual news. Do you do anything individually that's trying to, I guess, maybe give your brain a break in terms of financial news?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, Ryan. I set a high bar for the sources that I go to, and I don't spend a ton of time going through endless email streams and news streams. It's definitely a less is more. I'm very blessed to have a team of 28 people on staff here that I can kind of have as a first filter through on, they know what I'm looking for. But other than that, I think we've gotten into a period where you need to like really work to trust the context and the sources of the information you're getting. And we have lived in an era and continue to live in an era of way too much kind of borrowed conviction or rented conviction from other people. And so for me, it's incredibly important to raise the bar for what gets in my head, think about long shelf life information, stay a bit out of the day-to-day, rely on my team. And then there's also some kind of personal hygiene where I'm a runner. I like to get out and just be off the screen and think and ponder. And that's a very clarifying thing to do. As well as I journal every single day. I still write in cursive. And I write about things I learned in any given day. And then over the course of years and years, you start to see patterns of what is signal and what is noise. And what new sources, people, contacts, context are fruitful in giving you signal versus noise.
I really like that. Let's shift gears a little bit to Parnassus's investment process. What does the idea generation process look like? So who's coming up with the new ideas? Is it from the analysts on up or portfolio managers? What's the split look like?
Yeah, so the split ebbs and flows. I would say more stock ideas come from the analysts than the PMs. You know, could it be 2/3, 1/3? It could be. That can move over time. But really, the most important thing about the process here, Ryan, is that it's really about investing behind the Parnassus way. And as we kind of gave you a little bit of a nibble already, we're high quality investors, high conviction, high active share. And we're looking for an archetype of a company or a stock to invest in where the first thing is, does it have a durable moat? And so that is so important to what analysts are looking to pitch to us. Durable moats are companies that have that competitive advantage that they can generate excess returns on capital, deploy capital in the business, and do that in a way to compound value versus your cost of capital. So the moat is like by far the most important thing we look at. So analysts know, and we have a very detailed process of like how to replicate the process of determining moats. And so that is the durable bedrock component of our investing when combined with the next part, which is companies that are increasingly relevant, and relevant being that they can grow at least in line or faster than their industry, or at least in line or faster than the economy. Do you see where the magic comes in? Of compounding wealth is that the moat gives you that downside protection, the durability, the focus on the long term, the signal versus the noise. Then the relevancy is the compounding flywheel that causes growth, that pushes return on invested capital, pushes capital deployment, and increases the intrinsic value of the company long term. So analysts are looking to populate our portfolio, 40 stocks in the case of the Core Equity Fund, 25 stocks in the case of the Core Select ETF, to find 40 stocks that underwrite to good returns, that have moat and relevancy. And then wrapped around that, Ryan, is the concept that, like, not every stock has the same role in the portfolio. When we roll things up, some companies are long-term quality compounders that say underwrite to 10 to 12% returns. Those are the John Deere's, the MasterCards, the Lindy's, the Costco's, those quality long-term compounders. But then built around that will be defensive and offensive investments. So the defensive ones might be a Procter & Gamble, which we've owned since, I think, 2004. AutoZone, you know, companies that are just like durable, low cyclicality. They gave us a defensiveness to the portfolio. On the flip side, on the more growth side, you're going to have moats and relevancy, but that are offensive investments. And those, think NVIDIA, Applied Materials, Broadcom, Amazon. So in that is putting together 40 stocks that have moats and relevancy, Ryan, but they all play different roles to ultimately give the investor the experience of 40 stocks, high active share, high conviction, downside protection, and then asymmetry to upside. And then each stock plays a different role in the portfolio, be it quality compounder, defensive, or offensive.
Okay, and we're going to dig into a couple of those companies here in a sec, but I want to, I guess, stick to the Parnassus process. What does, kind of give me a sense of the assembly line, if you will. What does it take for a new idea to make it into a Parnassus portfolio? What is the process like from an analyst saying, okay, I've got a new idea, to Todd, I think you should throw this in the actual portfolio?
Yeah, so the first thing is there's a filter of quality, Ryan. So to make a long story short, say there's 1,000 companies in the Russell 1000. We end up getting to about 150 companies that are on our focus list. So you can see there's a pretty high bar for quality. And we're filtering out companies due to no moat, lack of sustainability, lack of relevancy, excess leverage. We stay away from companies that are non-financials over 4x debt to EBITDA. And then we have a size component, you know, avoiding companies that are under 20 billion. So what's left is about 150 companies split over 5 sector teams. So the job of those analysts are to scrub their sectors on that focus list, to look at the companies that have met our high bar for quality, to look at fundamentals, return profile, catalysts, to look for a company to present to us that could be included in the 40 stock portfolio. So again, we're going from 1,000 to 150. And then of that 150, those analysts, the assembly line, are going to look and they're going to say, hey, Todd, team, XYZ company, I'll just say John Deere, even though we've owned it since 2019. John Deere, the stock's undervalued. We're at the trough of an ag cycle. It's got a wide moat because of its dealer network and technology. It's got relevancy due to precision agriculture and a long-term uptake in the industry's capital intensity on those. It looks undervalued, underwrites good returns. They write an investment review that ultimately goes through moat, relevancy, management, underwrites returns, cash flows, sustainability assessment, and that gets put on our desk. And then ultimately we can decide to buy it or not. So really it's about coming off that focus list, deep dive in the analyst team, investment review, ultimately bought by the portfolio manager. And that's the process behind it, Ryan.
If the idea starts with you, if it's a new idea, a new idea comes to you, comes across your desk, and you're the first one to sort of see it, you think it's in your domain, do you go through that same process? Are you writing up an investment review for someone else to take a look at? Or I'm just curious, when it comes from you, what does that look like?
Yeah, so really, if it comes from me, which is a great question, and some do, and some come from Ben Allen and Andrew Choi, my other co-managers, it just goes through the same process. And so I'm not an analyst on any stocks, but I will write up maybe a page or so on what I'm seeing and then have an analyst do the work. And then we're really about, Ryan, consistent process at Parnassus. So, you know, you find you make mistakes when you cut corners. And so clearly, if I have an idea, it would go to the top of the stack of things to work on. But I would say it goes through the exact same rigor, exact same process, exact same format, exact same template of the investment review. Everything is the same. And so that way we have a consistency in how they're evaluated. And it's not known that, you know, one analyst or one PM is cutting any corners.
You've just mentioned, and you've said this before, you're looking for businesses that'll be more relevant in the future. And I think you've maybe given timetables on that before, kind of longer term, 5-year, 10-year type of thing. Are there common characteristics that you tend to find those businesses that end up being more relevant possess?
Yeah, so there's kind of a couple different flywheels of that. Number one are incredibly innovative companies that are on the wave of exponential innovation, where the percentage of the product is increasing long-term as a percent of GDP. And that would be semiconductors. And so the semiconductor industry, as you know, chips are more, you know, silicon everywhere. We've gone through major waves of compute between, you know, personal computers to, you know, mobility with phones and handsets, to cloud computing, to now AI. And each step of the way, you know, semiconductors have become an increasingly important content of value creation. So that's one part, but really it's based on innovation, right? On the flip side, you'll have companies that are incredibly durable where there's not a lot of innovation, but the company is able to stay increasingly relevant due to the positioning of the industry within the context of the global economy. So that would be something on the order of like a Waste Management or a Linde. For example, Linde sells industrial gases. There's not a lot of innovation in industrial gases, right? We kind of know the ones that exist on the periodic table, which we all should admit we should have studied more in high school, including myself included. But industrial gases continue to gain share globally, and the company benefits because of its dominant scale and ability as industrial gases go in from decarbonizing refineries to going into all sorts of different, you know, products, even hydrogen and transportation fuel. So Linde is somewhat innovating, but they're really benefiting from what they sell increasing in relevancy. And then point number three would be just super durable companies that just possess incumbency, like a, say like an AutoZone that just really gets in there, and over time they're just entrenched where, you know, cars become more expensive to repair. They have a network effect on distribution, and it's like the business model evolves, so they become more relevant because they can consolidate an industry. Do you see what I'm saying? So like it's like they're consolidating the industry. Praxair has it where they're not innovating a lot of new gases, but because of their over the wall, those gases are more relevant. They benefit from that. And third would be semiconductors are just silicon everywhere, but there to stay relevant, you got to innovate, right? So that one you got to run the hardest. Linde the next, AutoZone the least, but AutoZone has a favorable industry structure as well as Linde to like become more relevant due to consolidation.
It makes sense on the third point there, where with AutoZone, for example, you can see the economies of scale in the financials, like superior margins relative to sort of the mom and pop shops, maybe in comparison. With the innovation side, what are you looking at or tracking to get a sense of, okay, this company is truly innovative relative to their peers? Is it discussions with customers, discussions with management teams? How do you get a sense of that?
Yeah, so it really comes down to what value you are unlocking with the ultimate innovation. So if you think over time to the semiconductor capital equipment industry, so think about companies like Applied Materials, Lam Research, you know, KLA, Tencor. The question is, can your innovation be more valuable to your customers, right? And so when you think about what Applied Materials does, I love the name because materials is in the name. And when you think about what they do is they not only help their customers build the most advanced transistor structures in the world, how they're stacked, how transistors are built to, you know, that resistance and capacitance to make them faster and faster. So AMAT is any innovation they do goes upstream to create tremendous value. A, they enable the manufacturing of the semiconductors. But B, they make them more power efficient and more performance oriented for their customers to benefit from that innovation. As we're on this call right now, this is really driven by semiconductors. So AMAT's innovation unlocks return of capital for TSMC and the fab, which is unlocking innovation for NVIDIA upstream. So it's not a question that there's not profit dollars for Applied Materials in their innovation because they're enriching customers upstream, right? So that innovation is very valuable. The same would go to a company like Synopsys, which is an electronic design automation company. They design the software that designs the chips. So you think about that innovation, you're unlocking incredible value up the stream, right? That innovation is incredibly valuable. On the flip side, there can be other companies that innovate value, but that value doesn't translate into a lot of value for their customers. And so, for instance, going back to my father as an airline pilot, airlines can come up with very unique marketing schemes and frequent flyer programs and new route structures and more efficient ways to run the airlines. But anything they do gets competed away because it doesn't add a lot of value to you and I deciding to fly American versus United versus Delta. So like you can come up with innovation, but if the ultimate users are in commodity businesses, that innovation is not fruitful. So the key thing is, to summarize this super succinctly, you've got to be innovating something that is hard to do, hard to replicate, unlocks value for your first level of customers, and unlocks value for the ultimate customer. And again, no better way to go, just follow the money in semiconductors, Synopsys designing the chips, or selling software to design the chips, Applied Materials providing the technology to build them, TSMC buys the equipment from, obviously, Applied Materials. Ultimately, NVIDIA is designing them, all those, and then finally going to a hyperscaler who's also making money from them. So do you see where the money is just flowing? And it's your job to follow that innovation stream versus other industries that are pretty quickly hit by commodity margins, and that's where the party stops.
I like that. Are there any specific traits you look for from management teams? I assume you kind of have to skew a little larger in terms of the companies you're looking at. So if it's kind of an older company, you might not get necessarily founder-led anymore because they've been around for so long. Maybe in some cases, there's still a founder there. But are there any traits for, I guess, new management teams or people that are not, they don't have just the direct incentive of being aligned with you in terms of they're also an owner? Are there some traits, incentives that you're looking for?
Yeah, they're not all like, you know, Jensen Huang, who is he's a founder and I think runs his business with the same kind of level of energy and ability to take risks that he ever has. And that's incredible. I would say a couple things, Ryan, is that what happens when companies get larger? The number one thing that I see is complacency. Companies that have complacency at the high end, those companies will put their moat and relevancy at risk. There has to be an ability to be hungry, always learning, take risks, and do it responsibly, of course. But you have to have that almost Andy Grove-like paranoia to have a culture at your company, hire best people, listen to your customers, and also just be radically open to feedback. And it can be harsh feedback, but just you have to have management teams that are on the ground, meeting people, meeting customers with their employees and on top of the pulse. Because I guarantee you, these large companies, good information travels up quickly, bad information doesn't. And if you're sitting in an ivory tower and you're getting complacent, that's when you can lose a business. So, and obviously there's skin in the game and ownership and governance and ethics and all those things are important. But the minute you get a sense there's complacency, that's the seeds for long-term underperformance.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit and talk a couple positions in your portfolios. The first one here is Deere, I guess John Deere, for anyone not familiar with the shorter corporate name. What is happening in the agricultural industry overall right now? I think you've used the term kind of rolling. There's different rolling recessions in various industries, and I imagine that might be happening if you just look at some of the top-line numbers for Deere. And then the second, I guess, follow-up here is what has changed for them to be able to sort of weather these cycles better now?
Yeah, it's a great question. So for your listeners out there, one of the biggest sources of alpha for the Parnassus Core Equity Fund over the years has been industries that have something where a cycle, you know, short-term turns against you, but then you get a secular re-rate. So the hack term here is cyclical recovery, secular re-rate, right? Cyclical recovery means you're buying at a trough on earnings, hopefully a trough on multiple. Secular re-rate is you get paid on earnings going up, multiple going up, and that's how you make, you know, multiples on your money. So in the terms of Deere, we've owned the stock since 2019 and the last, of course, most recent kind of vintage of investment. What's happened is Deere is an unbelievable company. There's very few companies that have outperformed the market on, say, the trailing, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30, you know, long term. Deere is a remarkable asset versus the S&P 500 going back, you know, 100 years. In the most recent cycle, we've had a bit of a rolling recession in agriculture, Ryan, that, you know, when the Ukraine war hit in 2022, crop prices, corn, soybeans all, you know, went up to pretty high levels. So farmer profitability hit, you know, really high levels. And obviously that spurred a big cycle for Deere. Since then, we've seen oil prices come down, corn prices come down, farmer profitability come down. Most recently, some concerns about tariffs impacting, you know, farmer profits. So the industry's, in terms of ag, is in a rolling recession right now. And you see that in Deere's numbers. Sales are down, earnings are down, farmer profits are down. But that's the exact time where, you know, Deere is at its best. They're rolling out remarkable technology to turn tractors into data centers on wheels. And we've all heard about precision agriculture, which things like their See and Spray, where they can go every row of corn and look using artificial intelligence and machine learning, you know, where to plant, how to plant, using less water, less pesticides, less fertilizers, how we combine, how we spray. They've got data on hundreds of millions of acres. So Deere is turning into a data-centered precision ag company that used to bend green metal. And you can see the margins and software, all those things are really supportive. So as we look at the company today, they're in a trough, sales are down, but ironically, the stock is near all-time highs because people are looking forward, and that each cycle we've been in, they've seen, you know, higher margins, higher peak margins, higher trough margins, and the company is incredibly well positioned between now and the end of the decade to benefit as farmer profits ultimately improve. The age of equipment is old. There needs to be an upgrade cycle. And long-term, we think there's incredible, you know, margins that can come out of Deere. So this is an American icon that's in a, you know, cyclical downturn. But I think, you know, 3 years from now, earnings a lot higher, put a strong multiple on the stock, innovation, more software, more data. I think the direction of travel is pretty favorable for Deere.
When I look through your portfolio, Deere being one example here, but it kind of all across, it seems like you've got some businesses that I would think maybe get stronger through a recession because, you know, they're more advantaged than their competitors or maybe better position, better balance sheets, that kind of thing. Does it get you excited at all when you see maybe like industry-wide slowdowns and you know that you've got sort of the advantaged players? Does that kind of, I don't know, does it, even though the top line numbers might not be as exciting, the earnings reports might not feel as good when you see the numbers specifically, does it excite you at all?
They do. And, you know, again, these are challenging times at the moment. There's a lot of uncertainty globally and, you know, tariffs, and we come off a period of inflation. So like, clearly it's a unique time in the market, and there's a human toll that comes to that for people. And if there's economic cycles, those can be challenging. But I think from an alpha generation standpoint, this is entering a pretty rich time potentially for our strategy. And you're absolutely right, Brian, that what we're seeing somewhat now, we can get into more of this later, is that when you see stressors to the system, and that can be higher rates, tariffs, economic cycles, rolling recessions, those expose fragilities in the competitive environment. And if you're investing in a company that is doubling down during times of slowdown. Those companies accelerate share gains during, you know, when those companies, you know, come out of their industry downturn. So, you know, for us, whether it's places like life sciences, we've seen a downturn coming off of COVID on, you know, researching vaccines. Obviously, the funding environment's down for the IPO market. Companies like a Danaher or a Thermo Fisher can come out stronger. They're doubling down and tripling down on their R&D. We already talked about John Deere. They're doubling and tripling down on precision agriculture. Go through, you know, some other, you know, companies, even say in the housing market, right? We like companies like a Sherwin-Williams, Equifax, companies like Intercontinental Exchange that own the mortgaging and servicing software assets to underwrite mortgages. Those are just great places to be. They might not feel good now, but these companies are cobbling together, in Sherwin's case, you know, consolidating share around their dealer networks. Someone like Equifax bringing new tools and products into their credit underwriting and employment services. Or on an Intercontinental Exchange, new software that helps you underwrite and service mortgages more effectively. The seeds are all intact there to gain share in the next recovery because they have the balance sheet, the people, the tenacity, the risk-taking, and the long-term vision to invest. So clearly, the key is to provide downside protection during these types of environments, but then fragilities and cycles, that's the alpha generation on the way down, and then it's the compounding mechanism when things improve.
Okay, and I want to pick your brain on AI and semiconductors and sort of everything that's going on, but one more before we get to that, and this is when I think of companies being disrupted by AI, this is maybe, I would guess, on the other side of that spectrum where the company's waste management. I can't imagine that there's a lot of VC dollars pouring into competition for waste management. I guess, why do you think this business will be more relevant in the future? And then just in general, what gives waste management such a wide moat?
Hey, listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs this show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically. So head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview.
Yeah, so we've, Ryan, owned waste management since 2007. So, you know, been pushing an 18-year hold. So that's the goal of long-term investing. Really the relevancy, you know, comes out of a couple things. Number one is obviously super advantaged network of waste facilities. And the company really benefits. There's a lot of intriguing kind of waste to energy things that go on in those sites. Number two is recycling. There's a, you know, a lot of, you know, upside that they have through that business and even using AI to help determine, you know, how to do a better job on getting the yield of the plastics and the cans and what goes on the recycling facilities. You know, point number three is they bought Stericycle. That's involved in the whole medical waste, which is, you know, increasing in relevancy over time. And there's a lot of disposal of that. And four is they have a large network to use AI on how they route trucks, how they, you know, use labor, how they use their assets, all those different areas. They have the scale to implement technology to drive margins higher versus, you know, their pricing because of the super wide moat. So again, great spot where wide moat, you can't just permit a lot of these zones. They work hard to have good relationships with their municipalities to get pricing. They control costs through their scale and even AI. They have recycling, again, health waste, that's a growing business, and then waste to energy. So there's a lot of things that give it a durable base, but they're investing in the future to grow this business and its cash flows kind of as far as the eye can see.
Okay, let's talk a little bit of AI. We saw a major acceleration in CapEx from the hyperscalers, primarily in 2024. We saw a major acceleration, primarily related to AI investments. What do you make of the increased spending? And do you think there's any risk of overinvestment here?
Yeah, that's a. I wish we had more time. We could hit the hourglass for another hour just on this. But let me delve into that, Ryan. So, you know, first point is like clearly we're in a very major investment cycle for AI. That's stating the obvious. But really, I think what's happened here is since the evolution of ChatGPT and the initial Hopper GPUs from NVIDIA. That unlocked a huge wave of not only opportunity for hyperscalers, but also an existential crisis. Because now we have a new business model through AI, which is threatening a lot of these large companies, whether it's Google and search, Meta, digital ads, obviously Amazon, Microsoft, where what does this all mean for our business? Because of their massive cash flows, they bought a ton of GPUs to accelerate their computing, to basically not only solidify their existing business models, but to then go on this whole wave of artificial intelligence as we go long-term agentic. And so what's happening now is that after Hopper, now we're on Blackwell, and it all comes down to that token per watt of power as we inference and we have more valuable work streams through to AI. And so, as Jensen said 2 weeks ago, he's like the chief revenue destroyer. So a lot of these people bought Hopper chips, and they were great for those initial queries you did on ChatGPT, back in 2023. Now we're on to human reasoning and inference, and these models are getting better. They're becoming agentic. They're able to make decisions at like a 150 IQ. So the amount of compute, Ryan, continues to go up as we adopt Blackwell, which is way more efficient than Hopper. And then next year we have, according to Jensen, Vera Rubin coming out that's way better than Blackwell. So to summarize this, 2025 looks like an enormous wave, including the second half of the year, as we ramp the Blackwell chips and do inference and agentic AI and continue to ramp that. We're going to have to see ultimately like how that becomes a business model and becomes monetized at whether it's $20 a month, $200 a month, and then does it get ultimately more adopted at numbers much bigger than that? And if 2026 hits and you see more agentic AI, more reasoning, more value, and then you have the Vera Rubin launch, you could see this continue on for quite some time. These companies have the balance sheet to invest. It's an existential crisis for them to do it. You have sovereign AI globally. And if it gets adopted in work stream, so ultimately we are going to probably overinvest. I don't see it at the moment yet.
I'm seeing we're seeing this in the valuations of a lot of companies today where these are historically great digital businesses. And I'm thinking of kind of the Googles, Adobe, Salesforces of the world that are now their moats are kind of being called into question because of the rise of AI. Do you think that's warranted? Do you think these businesses are at risk, or could AI be sort of a enhancer for them?
I think long-term, at some point, Ryan, everything's at risk. So Google can't sit still on search. All these digital ads and how you reach customers, they all are at risk. And I think we're going to have just incredible disruption in the economy over the next 3 to 5 years. So at some point, Ryan, almost all physical assets are going to have a digital twin that's ultimately powered by some sort of AI factory. And that's kind of coming from Jensen from GTC. So even if, like he mentioned, you're running a supermarket, which is a physical asset, you're going to have a digital twin, AI, basically decision-making agentic type of work stream that's helping you run the physical assets. So that's going to be helping you make decisions and what inventory you have, how you reach your customers, how you market, how you hire people, how you fire people, how you compensate people. And then behind that, you're going to have your AI factory running all that. So I think there's a massive wave of adoption. So I think everybody is some point at risk, whether you just own a physical assets and you need to deploy a digital twin, or your Google, and you have to make search interactive and commercial and be able to launch the decision-making and make it agentic. So because of that existential crisis, I think we're answering the previous question is, when are you at risk of overinvesting? It's when the actual scaling laws of training models, or the scaling laws of inferencing them, which is really defined as like getting predictive output from a model, the minute those scaling laws flatten out, that's when we've got an issue. But as long as the scaling laws of training a model, which is obviously OpenAI getting their $40 billion at a $300 billion valuation, or Anthropic, think about that. As long as the scaling laws are ramping on training and inferencing, it's an existential investment to invest. Because if all of a sudden Google blinks and doesn't, threat of losing their monetization. So that's really the things to look at. That's what we look at, is how the scaling laws, those power laws, are working. And right now, those are still scaling, as evidenced by clearly the NVIDIA roadmap with Blackwell and Vera Rubin have massive scaling per watt of energy. And that's going to lead investment, and that's going to lead those that face existential crisis to invest.
Yeah, that all sounds kind of wonderful for NVIDIA. I imagine for the shareholders of the Google, in this case, for example, would it worry you to kind of have this, CapEx treadmill, I guess, where you're constantly having to invest more in those NVIDIA GPUs to keep a pace with the next model?
Well, I think that's where we're at right now. And as you know, Jensen says, the more you buy, the more you save, which is because their accelerated computing reduces their, obviously cost per token and helps them monetize. I would say we are, though, going to see a proliferation of custom silicon. And so think about companies like, Broadcom, which we're invested in. They're helping to design chips for companies like Google and others that are designing their own custom silicon. And, one of our investments, Ryan, that Synopsys, we talked about earlier, that designs the software that designs the chips, we're going to have a whole proliferation of custom silicon. Amazon has it with something called Trainium. Google has it with TPUs, obviously Broadcom. That custom silicon, and of course, AMD is out there competing, and maybe eventually Intel, to compete for that profit pool that NVIDIA has. But yes, right now, NVIDIA has the deep wide moat. They can sell rack scale AI factories. And yes, there is an existential crisis that they're helping to solve, a very important part of accelerated computing for their clients. So yes, capital intensity is high. My sense is it's probably peaking now in terms of the capital intensity, as number one, they start, monetizing those investments over subsequent years. And number two, they over time probably start to use more custom silicon, which is a bit cheaper for them. So, but I think NVIDIA still has a pretty bright future, even in a custom silicon world.
Were you, going back to when you first started studying semiconductors, were you assigned to look at semiconductors, or was that your own intellectual curiosity?
I wish I could claim credit that it was my own, but our founder, who I talked about, Jerry Dodson, at the beginning of the call, beginning this conversation, he was a contrarian investor. And I've mentioned this, that our alpha generation has come from cyclical recovery, secular re-rate. And that's what I would ask your, listeners to put down and write it on your refrigerator when you invest. If you can hit that, you're going to hit a lot of home runs. And so when I started in the business in 1995, there was a downturn in the semiconductor industry. And that, in essence, there was an oversupply of chips, specifically memory chips, which are more of a commodity. And the stocks all came down hard in the summer of 1995. So it just so happened that, success in life is like kind of like luck meets preparation, or preparation meets luck, whatever comes first. And so the semiconductor stocks just got hammered in the summer of 1995. And I was a young 22, 23 at that point. And our founder was like, let's go down and check out, companies like Applied Materials, because they were all down because there was an excess supply of chips. Prices were low, profits low, stocks down. We've heard this story before. And then back then it was all about the PC cycle and, Windows coming out and new upgrades. And we happened to hit a cycle, and kind of the rest was history after that. So it was just really just, I'm lucky it was semiconductors that were cheap at that point and not something that doesn't exist anymore. So that started a 30-year journey, and I've been through 8 semiconductor cycles now. So,
wow.
You know.
Yeah, that's quite the industry to kind of fall into, I guess, that early in your career. Okay, last couple wrap-up questions here. First off, do you think your investment approach has changed over your time at Parnassus? If so, how?
Great question. It has somewhat. Like any strategy, sometimes you do have years you underperform. And the best thing you need to do is learn from them. And our strategy underperformed back in like 2004, 2005, and 2006. Sounds like ancient history, but what happened then is we were looking at businesses that had wide moats, but had something called declining relevancy. And it fits perfectly into the discussion we just had. And it was a learning lesson, is we invested in newspaper stocks in 2004, coming out of, there was a, you know, it's ancient history now, but there was a downturn after dot-com bust, 9/11, recession. And 2004 was a year of improving economy, an election year, and then the Olympics, which were great for TV networks, advertisements, and there was cyclical recovery. And newspaper stocks like always outperformed under that because it was like they sell ads, right? I mean, people are, you know, this is dating this, but I think there's a lot of learning in it. And the essence, Ryan, was that we timed it and the stocks weren't working by 2006. And lo and behold, there was this company called Google that was starting to take the market share of digital ads. And newspapers were losing those mini monopolies. And so you could be really focused on a moat, Ryan, and moat and valuation. Remember we said numbers, games of chance, math. But I missed it on relevancy because all of a sudden I was like, are people going to be reading newspapers 5 years from now? And again, this seems like obvious now, but it wasn't so obvious in 2005, right? When you commuted to work, everybody still had a paper, but you kind of noticed they weren't reading them the whole commute anymore. Anyways, we become more focused on relevancy in the last 15 years. And that's key because now with AI, disruption, value traps, changing economy, if you can't answer the question, is this business more relevant 5 years from now, you're putting your clients' money at risk. So if Parnassus is at its best, we're finding, you know, wide moat companies that are going to be more relevant in 5 years. And that would be, say, a company, like we said, Synopsys, that we need to design new chips. We got to design them faster, cheaper, and use less power. And we're going to need more chips today, more chips tomorrow, more custom silicon chips 5 years from now. And so that's the key thing, for example, on that company. So it's relevancy. We're going to have incredible change in our economy in the next 5 years. And if you miss that, you can invest in the best mode of the world. But if it's gone in 5 years, you're going to be putting your own money, your client's money at risk.
I like that. Last question here. What advice would you give to someone entering the investment industry today?
I would say things have changed a lot. When I first got in the business, I literally had no internet, no email, no cell phone, and went to the San Francisco Public Library looking at like microfiche to find things, or LexisNexis. So people that are in their 50s will know what I'm talking about. If you're in your 30s, it's awfully quaint and you had no digital footprint. So just think about that for a moment. It might be pretty hard to visualize that. So what I would say, what stands the test of time, Ryan, is ethics, emotional EQ, temperament, your mental health, and your ability to process with discernment. And all these things are sacred. It's a really hard time. There's a lot of, you know, stress, anxiety, fear out there. And I don't say this lightly, but to be a successful long-term investor, you have to manage your emotions, stick with the process, learn from setbacks, realize we're in a world where knowledge scarcity is going to zero with the AI wave. And you have to think about your temperament and your ability to process information long-term is more important than ever. And we're in a chaotic, more volatile world. And if you don't have that kind of temperament to withstand the stress, the anxiety, and the fear, and I wrote about this internally, those will those will steal your alpha and take your career away. Stress hurts your health and hurts your productivity as an investor. When you're anxious, you overextrapolate noise and you don't find signal. And when you're fear, and when you have fear, you don't have the conviction to, you know, let alone make a decision, but make strong ones. In the end, if you're going to get into this business, you're going to be part of a decision factory. That's what we are at Parnassus. We're a decision factory. We need to do and make high quality decisions every day. And so I would say, if you're going to be an investor and to come into this business, you need to be able to become a high quality decision maker. And how do you do that? Lower the stress, lower the anxiety, lower the fear, increase your mental fortitude, be rooted in ethics, wisdom, knowledge, be always learning, be motivated, learn from your mistakes, and also just socialize with other people in this era of the walled internet. You know, get out, meet people, look them face to face, because ultimately trust is a very important part of this business too. And just have fun and enjoy it. It's a beautiful mystery, and you know, it's been awesome to be a part of it for 30 years now.
All right, that is going to do it for today. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on the show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Thank you to Todd for joining the show, and thank you all again for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Ryan.